Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcast, or it's simpler to use a computer or a smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from France 24, NHK World Radio Japan, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We will begin with France 24. One of the key benefits of listening globally is the range of press opinions on various world events. This week, France 24 had many important international press reviews, and so half of today's shortwave report comes from there. The first is about the proposed law in the UK that will ban anyone born in 2009 or later from ever buying cigarettes. It's very controversial, but may be implemented. Of course, the bigger story has been the retaliatory strikes on Israel that Iran attempted. First, the Middle East press from Israel to Iran. Then the international press from The Guardian in the UK and the US. Next, Zelensky criticized the West for directly defending Israel while treating Ukraine differently. The Washington Post reported on Ukraine's bombing of Russian oil refineries. Liz Truss, who was the UK Prime Minister for 49 days, is backing Donald Trump and would like to lead the Tory party again. The Jordan Times said that they intercepted Iranian missiles to protect themselves, not Israel. The UK-based Middle East Eye points out that Jordan has the largest number of Palestinian refugees. Then several reports on the election for Prime Minister in India. The election will take about 2 months, and Modi is generally considered a certain winner. Press reviews include how Modi made India a much larger international force, how human rights have diminished under his rule, and how he had the current opposition leaders arrested and prosecuted. France 24.
To the UK next, where cigarettes may one day be a thing of the past. What's going on over there?
Yeah, it's on a lot of the front pages in the UK this morning. I'll show you The Mirror, for example. The cig-free generation, as they put it, it comes as MPs have backed a new bill which will see people born in 2009 or after banned from buying cigarettes. Each year, the legal age for buying cigarettes will increase by 1 year, which means an effective ban on smoking. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said he wants to create the first smoke-free generation. But it's not all been smooth sailing. You can see the Telegraph headline there. Leadership hopefuls defy Sunak over smoking ban. Well, I'll bring you a little bit more detail in the Financial Times. As Sunak has faced a Tory backlash over the vote. 60 Conservative MPs voted against the legislation, including several ministers. The Guardian have this explainer on who opposed the bill. Kemi Badenoch, Business Secretary Kemi Badenoch, the most high profile, in fact, the only cabinet minister to vote against. She said she agreed with the policy's intentions, but argued we should not treat legally competent adult differently in this way, also citing the difficulties she thought businesses would have on enforcing the matter. Another familiar name to rebel, well, that would be former Prime Minister Liz Truss. She led oppositions to the plans, making a speech in the Commons, lashing out at virtue signalling and finger-wagging, nannying control freaks.
Sticking with that top story, the Iranian strikes on Israel. Leo, what has been the reaction in the Middle East press?
Yeah, I'll start with the Israeli press this morning. This is the Jerusalem Post. They say that a four-decade shadow war is now in the open. Israel Hayom, a paper that's often had links to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, have the headline, an alliance against Iran. They remark that Israel have a second chance to turn the fight into a global campaign against terrorism, adding that Iran attacked with great power, but not great wisdom. Now Israel have to make decisions with the head, not the heart. Moving on to Haaretz, which is a left-leaning paper, often critical of the government. They urge restraint, retaliation, risks, all-out war, they say. The front page also sings the praises of Israel's defence system, which managed to protect the country from 99% of the missiles fired. On their website this morning, they also have this: Iran and Israel, one miscalculation away from war. This article says that while it's tempting to assume the situation can now de-escalate, the potential for regional chain reaction explosions is deadly, pointing out how Jordan is in an increasingly precarious situation lying between Iran and Israel. Let's look at the Iranian press now, starting with the Tehran Times. They have that headline, Clean Victory, celebrating what they call a moral and legal punishment of Israel. The paper, which is considered state-controlled by many, calls Israel's claim at having intercepted 99% of the projectiles egregious, adding that Iran's missiles had landed exactly where they were meant to. The piece ends by saying that Tehran could have easily destroyed big gatherings to give Israel a taste of its own medicine. It, however, decided to play by the rules, and it still somehow got condemned by Israel's Western patrons, is what they say.
How has the international press reacted?
In the UK, The Guardian actually have this article this morning, this opinion piece saying this crisis threatens us all. Netanyahu wanted a wider conflict and Tehran has walked into his trap. This article adds that Israel has always craved a mandate and justification for openly attacking Iran. Now they have it. This opinion piece argues that Israel's wisest course of action would be to take the moral high ground and present Iran as a dangerous rogue state and gaining international sympathy. On past form, however, it's unrealistic to expect Netanyahu to turn the other cheek. I'll finish with a couple of US papers, starting with the Washington Post, explaining how US President Joe Biden has counseled Netanyahu to slow things down. The US reaffirmed their support for Israel, but emphasized that they will not participate in any offensive against Iran, although some Republicans have criticized Biden for not being strong enough in his reaction. According to this piece, Israeli officials think that Iranian attack could turn the tables in terms of widespread international criticism over its actions in Gaza, earning them sympathy as a so-called victim. I'll finish by showing you this from the Wall Street Journal. They report that roughly half of the missiles fired by Iran either failed to launch or crash before reaching their target. So much for the vaunted ballistic missile capability of Iran. That's a quote from a US official.
We start with Ukraine, where President Volodymyr Zelensky has called on Western allies to maybe put in a little bit more effort.
Yeah, as you can see in the Kyiv Independent this morning, Zelensky has asked the question, why can't our allies defend us in the same way that they protected Israel? By defending Israel, the free world demonstrated that unity is not only possible, but 100% effective. That's a quote from Zelensky's nightly address. I'll bring you another quote, as you can see in the Kyiv Post this morning. Give us what we need and we will do the rest. That's from Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba, saying that even if allies can't act the same way as they did in Israel, at least give them the tools to do it themselves. I want to bring you this, which is in the Washington Post, which says that Ukraine's attacks on Russian oil refineries have deepened tensions between Ukraine and the US. On one hand, the Biden administration views the attacks as reckless and likely to raise energy prices. On the other hand, Kyiv sees them as vital in the war against Russia. Vice President Kamala Harris first made the request to Zelensky back in February to refrain from hitting infrastructure, a request that was ignored. In fact, Ukraine have doubled down on the strategy. The White House have been accused of prioritizing domestic politics over Kyiv's military goals. That's been denied. And while the US has acknowledged that keeping global energy markets is a vital aim for the administration, they say it's also important for sustaining support for the Ukrainian war effort in Europe. And an increase in energy prices risks dampening European support for Ukraine. Ukrainian aid, a senior US official is quoted as saying, the US positions all stand in contrast to Washington's allies in Europe who have defended Ukraine's right to hit Russian energy targets.
And now let's finish in the UK, where a former short-lived Prime Minister is causing quite a stir. Can you tell us more?
Short-lived indeed. It's Liz Truss, Prime Minister for 49 days, and she's backed Donald Trump to win the US election, as you can see in Politico. She also laid in to Joe Biden. It comes as Truss is promoting a new book, which comes out today. To put it mildly, it hasn't gone down exactly well. One line from Politico, they say, history is written by the victors, but that hasn't stopped Liz Truss from having a go. This is the Times who say that Liz Truss's book reveals a total absence of self-reflection. This article jokes that snakes were recently found to have self-recognition. At the other end of the league table are sea lions, jackdaws, and the mercifully endangered species commonly known as Liz Truss. The book goes into details of her failed time at Downing Street, which she says would not be rated well on Airbnb due to all the fleas. She also discusses being the PM when Queen Elizabeth passed away. We learned that Truss's reaction to the death was, why me, why now? She also says she hasn't ruled out running for Tory leader once again, saying she has unfinished business. This Guardian article discusses her US ambitions. The American version of the book carries praise from two hard right-line senators, Ted Cruz and Mike Lee, both vocal enemies of Biden. She also claims to be leading revolution against globalism, socialism and the liberal establishment.
Leo, you start in the Middle East and a strong statement from the King of Jordan.
A strong statement indeed, as you can see in the Jordan Times this morning. King Abdullah saying that his country's security and sovereignty comes ahead of anything else. It comes as Jordan has been embroiled in a conflict between Israel and Iran. Situated between the two, Jordan helped in shooting down Iranian rockets during that weekend's attack, although Jordan was quick to state that it was defending itself, not Israel. The London newspaper Al Arab states on its front page that the fate of Jordan itself is at stake and considers that Jordan has turned into an arena of confrontation between Israel and Iran, which raises the level of danger to its national security. The newspaper considered that the Jordanian army's interception of Iranian missiles heading towards Israel placed Jordan on a side opposing Iran. The Middle East Eye have this: Jordan facing scrutiny over Israel military ties. Jordan's involvement in intercepting the missiles bound for Israel has sparked questions about its security relationship with Israel. In a country with the highest population of Palestinian refugees, a man said that the downing of projectiles was to protect its own citizens, nothing else. But analysts say pro-Palestinian protesters could direct anger at Israel towards the country.
India, which is about to begin voting in its elections from Friday.
That's right. Naturally, Karis, a lot of focus on the man himself, Narendra Modi, who is widely tipped to win these elections when they come to an end in about 2 months' time. The Asian Age Indian newspaper here focusing on his words here yesterday. That was at a campaign in Assam, in which he told voters that his party has achieved more in 10 years than that of the Congress Party, which is India's main opposition party, than what that party has achieved in 60 years in Assam, pointing to investment in semiconductor manufacturing and infrastructure in the region. The Hindustan Times' editorial today, the paper focusing on Tamil Nadu, the southern state, the most populous southern state in India, which also has the largest number of seats in the parliament of all the southern states. Tamil Nadu has been an outlier in national politics, the paper says, due to its linguistic subnationalism. Basically, here, the regional language of Tamil, not Hindi, dominates, and Modi's party has never quite managed to conquer the state politically.
All right, and what reactions are we seeing from the international press?
Like the Indian papers, a lot of focus on Narendra Modi himself. This is from La Croix, the French paper, which evokes what it calls the Modi effect, once again talking about how he is widely tipped to essentially win these elections and begin a third term. In its coverage, the paper also looks at how he changed India for better, for worse as well. He transformed India. He propelled India to the international stage when it comes to the economy, when it comes to politics. albeit though at the detriment of human rights in the country. He's described as charismatic but autocratic. Modi, of course, has also relegated the rights of Muslim minorities in India while pursuing his Hindu nationalist political agenda. Today, the editors of The Guardian today remind us of the extreme measures that the Prime Minister took during this electoral campaign to prevent the opposition from campaigning. He froze their bank accounts. There were arrests. There were arbitrary prosecutions as well, noting that for Indians, though, the main concerns are unemployment and inflation, on which issues Modi has a poor record. Not to mention, he's people feel that corruption has also swelled under his leadership. So the arbitrary arrests of his competitors might indicate that he has much to worry about these elections.
Those press reviews are from France 24. France 24 may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. They are also available at most podcast sites, as is the Shortwave Report. Next, NHK Japan. Japanese firm Nippon Steel is in the process of acquiring U.S. Steel, though Biden is opposed to it. The shareholders have voted to complete the sale. A report on the process of determining where to bury nuclear waste in Japan. Australia has announced a new defense strategy, including a much larger budget. An Israeli poll found that 70% of the citizens oppose a counterstrike against Iran. The U.S. Pacific Fleet provocatively flew through the Taiwan Strait. NHK Japan.
The multi-billion dollar plan by Japan's Nippon Steel to acquire U.S. Steel may have run into another obstacle. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said she understands the views of President Joe Biden in opposing the takeover. Yellen chairs the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, a body studying the implications of the proposed acquisition on national security. Speaking on Tuesday, Yellen declined to comment on cases under review by the committee, citing the confidentiality of the process. Last month, Biden said it's vital that U.S. Steel remain an American company, domestically owned and operated. Despite this, U.S. Steel shareholders on Friday approved the takeover offer by the Japanese rival. It's unusual for a sitting president and the head of the Committee on Foreign Investment to comment on a proposed takeover before the committee makes a decision. This shows the sensitivity of the issue in the U.S. during an election year. Former President Donald Trump has stated that if he's re-elected, he would block the deal.
Local groups in a town in southwestern Japan have made a request to the town assembly that steps be taken for a survey for a possible disposal site for high-level radioactive waste. Genkai Town in Saga Prefecture hosts a nuclear plant with four reactors. Three groups submitted a petition to the town assembly on Monday urging steps for the survey. Japanese law requires the final disposal of high-level radioactive waste from nuclear plants to be buried in sites more than 300 meters underground. The law also requires surveys to choose the final disposal sites be carried out in three stages. The Genkai Assembly is set to hold an ad hoc committee meeting before the end of the month to discuss its matter. The town's mayor says he takes the petition seriously. He says he'll confirm its contents while observing the assembly's discussions. Now, the selection of nuclear waste disposal sites is an ongoing issue throughout Japan. In February, two municipalities in Hokkaido, northern Japan, that had applied for the first stage search were found suitable for the second stage. But some residents are calling for similar surveys to be done in places other than Hokkaido. The central government provides up to nearly $13 million in subsidies for the first stage survey. For the second stage, the subsidies can top $45 million. And all that geopolitical jostling has put Australia's leaders into a heightened state of alert. They've announced a new defense strategy, including a substantially bigger budget.
Our environment is characterized by the uncertainty and tensions of entrenched and increasing strategic competition between the United States and China.
The plan is aimed at protecting Australia in the medium and long term. It accuses Beijing of coercive tactics and calls for stronger deterrence. The government plans to increase defense spending by more than $32 billion U.S. dollars over the next 10 years, or 2.4% of GDP. And over the next 4 years, more than $600 million U.S. dollars will be earmarked for areas such as the development of long-range missiles. The defense minister says national security lies further afield than his country's coast. Australia plans to acquire nuclear submarines under AUKUS, which is the collective security framework with the U.S. and Britain. The Wall Street Journal reports Israel's war cabinet has been plagued with infighting over how to deal with Hamas in Gaza. It points to disagreements between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, and former Defense Minister Benny Gantz. Israeli media outlets suggest the country is also split on the issue. In a survey by the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, over 70% of respondents said they oppose a counterstrike against Iran, while 26% said they support it, even if this means it could undermine Israel's relationship with its allies. The U.S. Pacific Fleet says its Poseidon patrol aircraft flew through the Taiwan Strait on Wednesday. It was shortly after a rare call between defense chiefs of the United States and China. A spokesperson for the Chinese military's Eastern Theater Command sharply criticized the flight. He said their forces remain on high alert and will resolutely safeguard China's national sovereignty as well as regional peace and stability. The development came as top U.S. and Chinese defense officials held talks for the first time in 17 months. The nations continue to try to keep each other in check.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan. On shortwave, they are heard at 10 p.m. at 11735 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp and most podcast sites. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this listener-funded program, like Anchor supporters in Willits and Albion, California did this week, PayPal contact information is available at my website, outfarpress.com, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Your donations are essential for this weekly production and distribution of the show. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. Venezuelan President Maduro says that the United States has not lifted the sanctions that it said would end a year ago. Americans demanding a ceasefire in Gaza blocked major roads in California, Illinois, New York, and Oregon. Police in Germany raided and shut down a pro-Palestinian conference in Berlin. Radio Havana, Cuba.
The president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, denounced on Monday that the U.S. government has not complied with agreements signed, particularly with the lifting of the illegal coercive measures imposed against the country. Quote, "They never complied with a single comma of the signed agreement. Never. At this point, the United States of America signed an agreement and should have lifted all sanctions against Venezuela. All of them. That is the truth," he asserted. During his program Con Maduro Plus, the head of state said that the U.S. government, quote, asked us a year ago that it wanted to start conversations with us in a reserved and private manner, and that Venezuela has always respected the reserved and private character of the same, reaching the signing of agreements that had as their core, quote, "the total lifting of all illegal and criminal sanctions against Venezuela." I'm not saying it, the signed documents say it. There were more than 9 meetings, 6 meetings in Qatar with the good offices of the Emir of Qatar, and 3 meetings in Milan. Venezuela was represented in those meetings by Dr. Jorge Rodriguez, an expert in this type of conversation, by fellow Governor Hector Rodriguez, by the Attorney General of the Republic, Dr. Reinaldo Munoz, and by the National Commissioner of Human Rights, Larry DeVoe. He said, quote, "We have made claims within the framework of these conversations, but outside the talks, an agreement was reached with achieve the release of the political hostage Venezuelan diplomat Alex Saab last December the 20th. It was an exchange. They returned our kidnapped and tortured diplomat, and we returned a group of CIA agents, some of them had come in to invade Venezuela. As an exchange, as it is done in the international world. Protesters have blocked the major roads in the states of Illinois, California, New York, and the Pacific Northwest, temporarily preventing travel into some of the United States' most heavily used airports, under the Golden Gate and Brooklyn Bridges, and along a busy West Coast highway. In Chicago, protesters linked arms and blocked lanes of Interstate 190 leading into O'Hare International Airport at about 7 a.m. on Monday in a demonstration they said was part of a global, quote, economic blockade to free Palestine. This according to Rivka Faleh, one of the organizers. Protesters say they chose O'Hare because it is one of the most biggest and largest airports in the United States. Dozens were arrested, according to Faleh. Chicago police said that, quote, multiple people were taken into custody after a protest where people obstructed traffic but did not provide a detailed account. In California, demonstrators blocked lanes on the northbound 1880 in Oakland by chaining themselves to barrels, while a separate group of protesters with banners disrupted traffic on the southbound lanes. On the Golden Gate Bridge, protesters impeded traffic in both directions, displaying a banner that read, "Stop the World for Gaza." In Eugene, Oregon, protesters blocked Interstate 5, shutting down traffic on the major highway for 45 minutes. Meanwhile, on the East Coast, protesters marched into Brooklyn and blocked Manhattan-bound traffic on the Brooklyn Bridge. Police in Germany raided and shut down a pro-Palestinian conference in Berlin on Friday. The Palestinian Congress was scheduled to be held for 3 days, but the event was shut down as the first panelist spoke. In addition, Germany's Interior Ministry banned some conference speakers from even entering the country or addressing it remotely, including the former Greek Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis, the Palestinian-British surgeon Ghassan Abu Sittah, who worked in Gaza. Dr. Abu Sittah spoke to Middle East Eye after he was barred entry, saying, "Upon arrival, I was stopped at the passport office. I was then escorted down to the basement of the airport, where I was questioned for 3.5 hours. At the end of 3.5 hours, I was told that I will not be allowed to enter German soil."
Those reports are from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with a podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury and staying in a house that is connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.